Net-a-Porter presents The Incredible Women Podcast, Series 8, The Powerhouses.
Welcome to The Incredible Women Podcast, The Powerhouses, in partnership with De Beers. We sit down with women who are leading the charge in their industries, those who are admired for their unique talent, strength, drive, and influence. All at the top of their game, some of these incredible women you'll already be familiar with, and others we're very excited to introduce you to. I'm Kay Barron, Fashion Director at Net-a-Porter, and I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined for this episode by Elizabeth Day, the award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and chart-topping broadcaster.
I've got to the stage now where I refuse to be apologetic about the fact that I am busy and that my work is demanding, and I choose for it to be so because it's very meaningful to me and it gives my life purpose.
Now, recording a podcast can be intimidating enough, but it's even more intimidating when you're interviewing Elizabeth, who is the lauded host of the hugely successful How to Fail with Elizabeth Day podcast, which celebrates all of the things that haven't gone right, even for those guests who seem like they always have it together. And if that wasn't enough for her to be getting on with, she's also written 5 novels and 3 works of non-fiction, including her most recent book, Friendaholic, Confessions of a Friendship Addict, exploring why we need them, how we end them, and how they change through our lives. I found it very funny and very moving, and it made me think differently about some of my friendships, which is why I'm excited to delve deeper into it with her now. Welcome, Elizabeth. I'm thrilled to be talking to you.
I'm thrilled to be talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I know that you are the podcast expert, so do not judge me on my technique. My technique is usually using the wrong word in the wrong context, but let's see how we go on. I want to jump straight in and talk all things friendship, because even before you joined the call, we were talking about it and already had these amazing conversations about our friendships. And from reading your book, it really made me rethink some of my friendships. But what was your biggest realization from writing that book?
From writing the book, I think my biggest realization was how much my past behavior has been governed by guilt and insecurity, which fundamentally comes from low self-esteem. And actually, it's the same thing that caused my addiction to friendship. And as you know, the book is called Friendaholic. And that's a sort of splashy title, but it had a serious resonance for me where I did come to this conclusion that I had a dependency on that feeling of intimate connection, of making a friend, of meeting someone and them liking me. Like, there was that sort of adrenaline buzz that I depended on all through my teenage years and into my 20s, actually, which I think comes from a feeling of not having known myself sufficiently and outsourcing my sense of self to other people and being made to feel like I must be sort of okay if other people liked me. And so I think my biggest realization was understanding that. And that, of course, feeds into guilt, because if you're in the business of trying to make someone happy and trying to be the quote unquote perfect friend or perfect partner or perfect spouse or perfect daughter, actually, a lot of your time, you feel that you're failing at that and you feel as though you could be doing better. And then guilt makes you make bad decisions. And sometimes you keep on allowing people in your life who treat you badly simply because you want them to think well of you. And so I think that was the biggest realization, that actually, for me to show up authentically, I have to leave guilt and insecurity at the door and take the risk that that might mean I lose some friends, but it means that I will have more time to nurture the close friends who accept me as I am and the ones that are really meaningful to me.
Yeah, because the more friends you have, and obviously from, you know, in from different aspects of your life, the more that you're doing for them and not for you, which obviously is not how friendship or great friendships work. And I did think as well, when you were talking about having so many friends and collecting them and trying to maintain being that best friend you possibly could be, it sounded so exhausting.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of friends as pre-pandemic as well, and I never mixed them because I was always worried about what they might think of each other as well.
Ditto.
Which again is exhausting, and trying to organise your social life just ends up, you're out every night, every, you know, over the week because you're trying to see everybody. And also, I think it becomes frustrating for your friends as well. And then I had my 40th birthday, threw them all into a room together. But did you feel the pressure then to mix all your friends, or did you also keep them separate?
I really, really relate to that. And actually, the first thing you said was that idea of spreading yourself too thinly, that if you have too many friends, then you're constantly running around trying to meet their needs. And actually, another realization is that true friendship is not like that. It's not one way, that we reciprocally are there for each other. It's not necessarily about meeting needs or making someone happy. It's that reciprocal nature of acceptance and generosity of spirit. So thinking the best of someone. So my best friend, Emma, I know will think the best of me, even if I haven't been in touch for a week. I mean, that never happens with Emma, but I know that she would think, okay, well, Liz has her reasons and she's probably really busy, rather than, I can't believe that she hasn't got back to this text and I see her on Instagram and she looks like she's having a whale of a time. Like, that's, for me, not the truest form of friendship. And in terms of group mixing, I'm very like you, like I have very separate, I wouldn't even say groups of friends. I just have separate friends from different times of my life. But a bit like you, I actually really like having a big party. And that is not paradoxical to introversion, because actually having a big party means that you can have everyone there and you don't have to have a lot of depleting conversations, because actually you can just like flit around feeling like you're in a room of people who love you, and that's such a nice feeling. And a bit like you, it's actually been a really great experience when my friends have met each other. But that also is a good test of true friendship.
Yeah,
your true friends should probably approach meeting your other friends with an open mind and be open to the idea of liking them, rather than being possessive or jealous.
But what also really resonated, and we were talking about this before, is that brutality of ending a friendship. It's kind of all consuming, the guilt of ending a friendship and feeling that you've done the wrong thing. But don't you think it's so important?
Yes. I'm now in my mid-40s, and I think it's really important to know when to place a boundary and when to say no. And it's taken me a really long time to appreciate that. But in saying no, it means that you are reserving space to commit to a fully authentic yes. And actually that made it was a sort of light bulb moment for me. So it is important. That doesn't mean that it's not incredibly difficult. And part of the reason it's incredibly difficult is because of something I write about in Friendaholic, which is that we have not paid enough attention to friendship as its own form of love. And that means that we don't have a unique language either to express what friendship means to us or to reach for when we need to bring a friendship to a close. Whereas with romantic relationships, we do have that language. And yes, it's still terrible and awful and heartbreaking, but at least we know that we can say things like, it's not you, it's me. I'm just not ready for X amount of commitment. Whereas in friendships, we don't have that vernacular. And so often we find ourselves in a situation which isn't serving either party, but we're too scared or we don't know the words to reach for to do anything about it. And that means that sometimes the easiest thing, it seems, is to ghost someone, just to drop out of their lives. And as you'll know from having read the book, that happened to me in a really shocking and dramatic way, where one of my three closest friends, it felt like almost overnight, just vanished. And I can understand now, having written about it, I can understand why that seemed easier at the time. And actually, I have a lot of empathy for where she might have been in her life. But I promise you that it's not easier, because you'll probably be left feeling quite guilty if you're the one doing it. And if you're the one on the receiving end, it's a slow motion grief, the likes of which I have never before or since experienced, where I was just reworking the narrative in my own head, trying to think, well, what could I possibly have done that was so terrible to deserve this? So that's why I do always think it's better to signal that this friendship is not serving either party, or that you feel that it needs to evolve in some way. And there are various ways of doing that where you can lead with love. It doesn't have to be a sort of cruel ending.
But yeah, it's an incredibly hard thing to do. But do you think, from writing about it, from, and also hoping those people who've done it and who experienced it with you have read the book, Do you think you'd find it easier to do in future if you needed to?
Yes, I do think I'd find it easier. And actually, I ended a friendship during the course of writing the book. A friend of mine called Ella, and I must point out that I anonymized everyone unless they gave me explicit permission to write about them. I ended that one because we had just evolved in such different directions. And I realized that there was a way of doing it with loving clarity where she had texted me and she called me on it. She had sensed this. I'd gradually been sort of decreasing our contact. And I said, you know, I wish you nothing but the best, but I feel like we're in different places in our lives right now. And I'm going through some stuff and I'm sure you are too. And I sending you lots and lots of love. And, you know, perhaps we can pick this friendship up at a later date. And that's another thing that I realise is that hopefully life is quite long. And there are friendships that you can leave in one phase of your life that might come back in a different way much later on. And I think that's quite a heartening idea. And actually, once I sent that text and Ella, to her great credit, received it very well, it made me realise that actually sometimes you can end a friendship with loving clarity, and sometimes you can end a friendship in the same manner as you conducted your friendship. So the way that you communicate, I'm often asked how to end a friendship and it's so difficult, which it really is challenging. But ask yourself what your preferred form of communication was and then try and use that, because it might be that you are a better friend over text. It might be that you always met up for a cup of coffee and that's the way to end it. But there is a way of doing it with love. And I think there's so much conversation at the moment about boundaries and they sound quite clinical and cruel, but there are ways of doing it where you are doing it for the benefit of both parties. Because I guarantee you that if you're not happy in a friendship, the other person probably isn't either.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think I've had friendships with somebody, one of my best friends, and thankfully she still is one of my best friends, I've known since I was 4. And then we had a huge fight, I think, in our late 20s. And then we called them the lost years in between, and then came back together and our friendship is better for it.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Yeah, that sense of kind of rupture and repair. I think that that is a really good point, that it's these moments of friction and then communication that actually help us understand who we really are. And if a friendship is strong enough to withstand that, it makes you feel really safe within its parameters, and it's probably a friendship worth pursuing.
I also want to talk about friendships changing as we get older. I mean, I'm also mid-40s, don't have kids, which means my life is very, very different from wonderful friends who do have kids. But you've written so openly and honestly about your fertility. So how did you balance those changing friendships with what was happening in your life?
Well, your friends sound wonderful, and my closest friends are also incredible and very thoughtful. And I, like you, am in a minority, and most of my contemporaries have children. But some friendships did not stay the course. And I knew that it was very important for me to write a chapter in Friendaholic that dealt with friendship when all of your friends are having babies and you're not, but you're trying. For me, I've had sort of 12 years of unsuccessful fertility treatments and recurrent miscarriages. And it is a very difficult thing to go through, and it feels incredibly isolating, even if you have people you love around you. And I wanted to be able to speak for and to that community, because at precisely the time that I was starting to try and have children, it was also the time that it felt like there was this social fetishization of specifically motherhood, but parenthood quite generally. And it felt as though not having children was a kind of marginalized space. And at the same time, this fetishization did a disservice to real parents who weren't living an Instagram fabulous life. And I just wanted to introduce more nuance into that conversation. And it was really interesting writing that chapter, because looking back on it now, I read it back and think, gosh, I really was quite angry. And I don't feel that now. I feel much more at peace with it. And I think that's because I've let go of the idea of motherhood for myself. And it means that I can really embrace the joy of other people's children without feeling wrongly, this was my own misapprehension, but without feeling I was being put on trial to see what kind of mother I might be. And I think that some of the friendships that fell by the wayside didn't manage to have space for the imaginative empathy that a situation like that might require. And what I mean by that is that obviously it is a very kind of challenging, busy life having young children. And understandably, again, a lot of new parents will automatically assume that a woman who doesn't have children and who might be single, she's the one with the disposable time. And she probably wants to hang out with kids. So we'll invite her round for Sunday lunch, or she can come to our one-year-old's birthday party. And actually, when I was in the thick of fertility treatment or in the aftermath of miscarriage, that was the last thing I wanted to do. But I felt like the failure was mine for not wanting to do it. I felt like, well, if I can't want to do this, then I'm not meant to be a mother. Like, that's how my mind operated. And of course, there's a certain amount of responsibility on both sides, myself included. But it felt in some friendships, some outer circle friendships, as if there was no reciprocal effort being made. But with my closest friends, including Emma, they would always make space for our friendship within whatever they were going through. And that meant an enormous amount to me, even if it was going to visit Emma for a weekend and her saying, I just want to have 10 minutes with you and having a cup of coffee because I want to hear what's going on in your life. That went such a long way.
Yeah. And I think it's also because when you don't have kids and those, you know, if you're meeting someone for dinner, then you have that kind of the mum who's got freedom for the evening and are expecting, you know, maybe a kind of bigger night. And I'm like,
100%.
Just because I don't have kids doesn't mean I have the energy for this.
Yes.
But then you feel like you a sort of sense of responsibility that you then need to do that to give them a good time.
Yes. But then I think, again, I'm only just coming to terms with the fact that I am a functioning workaholic. And part of the reason I work hard is because I love my work and I find it very fulfilling, but it's also because I'm aware that there's a compensatory aspect to it. Like, I will never understand what it is to be a mother, and that is a grief in my life, and it's one that I live alongside. I am at peace with it, but I live alongside it every day. And so I've got to the stage now where I refuse to be apologetic about the fact that I am busy and that my work is demanding, and I choose for it to be so because it's very meaningful to me and it gives my life purpose. And so I think we all need to be a bit braver about that as well, because so often, oh, you're so busy is used as an implicit criticism. Mm. And as someone whose life has been historically governed by guilt, I just refuse to take that on anymore. I'm like, yes, I am busy because I choose for my life to be that way.
Speaking of incredible women, I'd love to tell you about another podcast that is top of our listen list. It Can't Just Be Me with Anna Richardson centers on shame-free conversations around everything from body image and sexuality to mental health and motherhood. With the help of a celebrity guest and an expert counsellor, Anna leaves no stone unturned in her quest to solve listener dilemmas. It Can't Just Be Me is such a reassuring listen. Recent guests include Sally Hughes, Sue Perkins, and Gabby Logan. And this week, the show is marking International Women's Day with a special episode about domestic abuse. Each episode of It Can't Just Be Me serves as a comforting reminder that whatever you're going through, it's not just you. It Can't Just Be Me is available wherever you get your podcasts, or itcan'tjustbeme.co.uk.
You know, being a friendaholic and having, you know, all these people in your life, but your job is actually very isolating because, you know, you have to be by yourself and in your head to write, come up with those ideas. And I love my own company, thankfully. And I think to be creative, you know, you kind of be around people for a little bit, but then I think for a novelist, certainly you must spend a lot of time on your own. But how do you balance that time on your own with the amount of friends and the people that you want to see?
That is such a great question and so astute and very kind of you to ask it, because I find that really difficult, because I do need a lot of time on my own and in my own headspace. And some, most of my friends now really understand that because I wrote a book about it. but I still find it hard to put into practice with new friendly acquaintances, for instance. So I am someone who loves connection. It's why I do everything that I do. It's why I write. It's why I do podcasts. I love understanding more about people. And if I happen to sit next to you at dinner, I will want to know about your childhood and how you grew up and what your parents were like. And actually, funnily enough, I've just come back from a weekend in Norfolk where I went to meet for the first time my husband's soon-to-be 91-year-old aunt, who is a Carmelite nun.
Oh, wow.
And she's been a nun, I know, since she was 24. And I essentially interviewed her for 2 hours because I was so fascinated. And so I'm very aware that I like connecting with people. However, I'm in danger of over-promising, because some people will interpret that connection with my offering my services as a lifelong friend. And I can't do that, and I can't commit to the time that that would require. And that's what I struggle with more. And I haven't yet found the solution to that, because I don't want anyone to feel that I'm not being genuine or that I'm not liking them immensely. I am. It's just that I also really need to protect my own space. And what I've started doing over the last few months is committing to 2 nights in a week that are just for me. So Mondays and Wednesdays, I don't go out. And that's been quite transformative. And it's taken me until now to have that, to implement that into my diary, because I always historically felt so much guilt about it. It was like, well, if I am technically free and I don't have anything in the diary, then I should say yes. If anyone asks me to do anything, I should say yes. And I realize actually, by saying yes to everyone else, I wasn't saying yes to myself.
I also want to talk to you about, you've become such an important voice for so many women.
But you
definitely are, because it's incredibly brave to be as honest as you are about your own life. But do you feel the pressure of that?
Thank you, first of all, because that really means the world to me. And I don't think I feel pressure in the sense that it's so kind of you to say that it's brave of me to share. Actually, it comes naturally to me to do that. And I only do it when I feel ready. So I always leave some time between living through the experience and then sharing it, writing about it, or talking about it. And I think that helps, because I understand where I fit in amongst the feelings of others. And so I think the challenge for me is having a strong sense of self and who I am, because I'm very grateful that I have this empathetic skill and I can intuit what else someone is feeling or what they might not be saying about their feelings. But the flip side of that is that I'm extremely sensitive to criticism, and I have developed a way of coping with that, because I still want to put myself out there and I still want to allow opinions and feelings in, because that's what connection and communication is to me. So it's not, I can't go and live on an island and in a hermit's cave in the middle of nowhere, because that would be denying what I believe is part of my purpose. So I have to put myself out there. And I now realize that not everything requires a response, and that if someone says something unkind on Instagram, or if they have misinterpreted my intentions, it's a bit like someone pointing at me and saying, I don't like your blue hair. And I know I don't have blue hair. So I've had to get a lot stronger about believing the same thing about my stances and my opinions. And sometimes, of course, I will get things wrong. And if that is the case, then I believe the best thing I can possibly do is to immediately apologize and go and educate myself. And that has happened. And actually, when I have done that and taken that risk and reached back out to someone, they have responded really beautifully. So I've got better at coping with it. And things like reviews of my books, I now no longer read because I know that I will remember the one bad one.
Of course.
for millennia.
Yeah.
And I'll forget all the good ones. And I just learned that it's much better for me that way. And then the other thing that I've instituted is to a 24-hour kind of response barrier, where if someone says something mean or posts a trolling comment, my immediate reaction will be, I want to say something and I want to defend myself. And I've learned that that's not the right thing to do. I'm going to leave it 24 hours. And by then it will feel different and I probably won't respond. So that's the only way that I experience my profile as occasionally challenging, but it's far outweighed by a lot of the amazing messages and responses that I get. And I don't feel that it's a pressure as much as a privilege, actually, to speak for the community that I speak for.
And I mean, but writing must be cathartic for you as well. Is that a kind of form of therapy?
Yes. I mean, I don't set out to write as therapy, but it just so happens that one of the wonderful byproducts of some of my writing is that it does lend that feeling of catharsis. So my last novel, Magpie, I wrote during lockdown. And not only was it therapy in the sense of like giving me something to do every day, it gave my days a sense of structure. But it was also therapeutic because I explored a lot of my own fertility experiences through the lenses of different characters. And that's, for me anyway, a very helpful process because it helps me contextualize my own feelings and my own grief. And so, yeah, I think that is sometimes a knock-on effect. And really, writing is how I make sense of the world. I sometimes don't know that I think something until I write it down on the page. And then I look back and I'm like, yeah, no, I'm glad I said that. Because I think it's the same reason a lot of people journal. They need to get their thoughts and their feelings and emotions out so that they don't turn them inwards and so that they don't then distill into a different feeling altogether and you can't actually name the thing that's bothering you. So I found it immensely helpful in that respect.
It's basically like an emotions chart. That's how I find writing. And then when you write it down, you're like, oh, actually, this is how I'm feeling, rather than it's just in your head, because then it becomes either the feeling becomes bigger than it needs to be or sometimes it becomes less significant than it was.
Exactly. And you can gaslight yourself in that respect and just think, oh, I'm being unreasonable or and actually it's therefore very helpful to write it down. And then the amazing thing about writing books is that you put them out into the world and other people, hopefully, if you've done a good enough job, will relate and they will think, gosh, that experience that was so personal to me, Elizabeth Day, has had resonance beyond my own personal experience of life. And that's been something that is like monumentally transformative for me. Like I now know when I go through a difficult time, I know that if I allow enough days to pass, I'll be able to look back on it and I will have learned something instructive, even if the failure itself was not instructive or meaningful. And I will be able, I hope, to put that into words and help someone else. And that's really the beauty of the chain of connection.
So this series of the podcast is called The Powerhouses. You are a powerhouse. Was there a moment when you felt like you'd made it? Or is it still something, which I know is kind of hard probably to answer yourself, or is it something that you're working towards? Or do you have a goal of like, this is what success looks like to me now?
Great question. Thank you for calling me a powerhouse. I love it. I don't have a goal. And I'm still working towards it, if that makes sense. So doing How to Fail has made me radically redefine what success means to me. Success now means not limousines and private jets, although that would be very nice. It means having the ability and the capacity to show up as myself in every single part of my life. So the me that writes a book, the me that does a podcast, the me that's on stage at a live show, it's always the same person as the me that shows up with my friends and that, and with my partner. And that to me is really important because for a long time in my life, I felt as though I were playing a series of roles and turning up in a series of masks. And so that, the ability to be authentic and to feel empowered in that way, that for me is success. And that definitely, it will be a lifelong work in progress. But that doesn't mean that I don't acknowledge the moments where I feel that I have achieved something and I feel that I am proud of myself. And one of those moments definitely came about last year when my editor called me up and told me that Friendaholic was a number one Sunday Times bestseller. Because I had never imagined that that would be possible. And I felt so emotional about it that all of these beautiful people, many of whom will never have met me, the majority will never have met me, and they have decided to spend some of their money on a book that I wrote about friendship. It just, in so many ways, it was a profoundly beautiful moment. So I think that was definitely one of those times when I thought, wow, I need to remember this.
And how did you celebrate that?
I actually had to do a book event that night. So I got the train to Liverpool, but my lovely book publicist, Naomi, who's a very good friend of mine, I brought a bottle of champagne and I think she did too. So we drank champagne on the train from Euston to Liverpool and it was fabulous. And then the week after, I went on holiday to Oman with my husband and we continued the celebrations there.
Oh, fabulous. And obviously I want to talk to you about your incredibly successful podcast. With all your guests, it does seem like nothing is off the table. And obviously before they do it, they must, you know, listen to previous ones. But how do you get your guests to open up to you?
I don't know. I mean, I think that it really helps that I ask them to come up with three failures in advance of recording. And so they've had a chance to think about what they're willing to explore, and they set the parameters of that conversation. So I want them to feel safe. And I will always say in advance of recording, that's my priority. If there's something that you say that you wish you hadn't, we'll cut it out. We want to make you feel safe and sound good. And then I think it's a question of, you know, people used to take the piss out of me when I was a print journalist for always liking the people that I was sent to interview. And for a while, I felt really bad about it. I felt like I had no discernment. But actually, it's that generally, I feel people are doing their best. They are trying their best. And I'm perpetually fascinated by why someone is the way that they are. And so I think that the genuine nature of my interest, I hope, comes across. And I think the other thing is that I strive to listen. So I will never write out a whole script. I'll have some topics that I want to cover, but I won't necessarily write out full questions because I want to allow the conversation to be free flowing. And I also want to allow us to go in unexpected directions and to really listen to what they're saying, because very often the thing that is most important is the thing left unsaid. And I want to be able to be receptive to that as well. So I think listening is a very undervalued skill as an interviewer. So maybe that's why. But generally speaking, they are lovely, I have to say, my guests.
I think that's always when somebody's so relaxed in that way. And also, I mean, you know, they're just leaving that gap and letting them fill the silence is that great trick, which took me as a journalist a very long time to learn. Because
I'm still too scared to do that most of the time.
Do you ever get nervous? Do you still get nervous when interviewing like a personal hero of yours or somebody that you can't believe
you've got? Oh, definitely. Yeah, I get nervous every time, genuinely. I get nervous every single time I do an interview because I get nervous that I'm going to be able to ask the right questions, listen in the right way, find the right word. But I think a modicum of adrenaline is really healthy. I mean, I did an interview the other day with Satnam, like one of my closest friends, and I got nervous about that. So I think sometimes you can use that little imposter syndrome-esque voice in your head. You can use that to your advantage because it just keeps you alive. And it keeps me very like in the present because I want to show up and do my best every single time. So yeah, I do get nervous. I do get really nervous if it is a hero.
I mean, I think nerves help me concentrate more, oddly.
Yeah, I agree. And it's why sometimes like adrenaline can be good before an exam. All in moderation. But yes, I definitely get nervous.
So I have read many rumours, obviously, about screenplays and TV work. But what is next for you in terms of writing, podcasts, TV, or something completely different?
Actually, this year I'm focusing on podcasts. So I relaunched How to Fail in January with a new logo, a gorgeous new studio, an amazing lineup of guests. It was our 20th season. And we relaunched with Dan Levy from Schitt's Creek. And he is just one of the most gorgeous people I have ever met. And so that's been really exciting me.
I think you and Dan are a dream team.
Oh, that's so nice of you.
I'm obsessed.
He is heaven.
Obsessed.
He is heaven. I just, in human form, he was so kind and empathetic and just like all the things you want him to be. So I'm really pleased we're launching with that episode. And so I'm very excited about that. And I'm also setting up a podcast production company with an emphasis on female and diverse voices, because although podcasting is a great community, I still feel that at the top of our charts, there are too many men. And I want to change that, because actually, to tell the right stories, we need the right voices. And I am writing a novel next, so it's very nice to be back in the world of fiction.
Amazing. I'm not sure how your guests can get bigger and better, but so I'm excited to see that. And then finally, who are the incredible women who are inspiring you most in 2024?
I, at the moment, am loving Ayo Edebiri, who is in The Bear.
She's amazing.
Isn't she amazing? And I absolutely adore her awards acceptance speeches, particularly the one where she shouted out assistance. I was like, that is so full of grace and authenticity, because assistance do make the world go round. And it's those people who are often the unsung heroes. And I love that she paid tribute to them and really acknowledged that they had had their part to play in her success. So I think she's amazing.
I'm with you on that.
I would also say Claudia Winkleman, who is a former guest on How to Fail. I adore her. I think she is so vastly intelligent and uber talented, and she wears it so lightly and with a kindness that elevates all people in her circle, particularly women.
I love her too. And also she's my fringe twin. So she's got great taste.
She is.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. I could talk to you all day, and I hope I find myself next to you at dinner so we can...
Ditto. We can just ask questions to each other all night. I loved it. Thank you for having me.
The Powerhouses was brought to you by Net-a-Porter and Chalk and Blade, hosted by Net-a-Porter's content director Alice Casely-Hayford and fashion director Kay Barron. The team at Net-a-Porter was Katie Berrington as the senior editor, with casting by Annabelle Brog and Olivia Wakefield, and coordination by Gabriella Pereira. The producer at Chalk and Blade was Laura Hyde, with help from Emily Wally. Original music by Alexis Adamora, and the series was mixed by Nasson de Silva. To make sure you hear all the episodes in this series, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information, go to net-a-porter.com.